You can now hear Stutter Talk on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and beyond. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com or in the app stores.
You know, how can you really understand something unless you're able to talk about it? Working on your fluency doesn't ever make you less afraid of stuttering. So that even if you get to a point that you're really pretty fluent, if you haven't dealt with those attitudes and feelings about stuttering, you're always going to have that fear and that anxiety about stuttering.
Stuttering Modification with Dr. Joseph Klein. Today on Stutter Talk. Hey everyone, welcome to Stutter Talk, changing how you think about stuttering one podcast at a time. This is episode 329 for April 15th, 2012. I am your host, Peter Reitzis, and I'm here to welcome back special return guest, great friend of the show, Dr. Joseph Klein. Hey, Joe, how's it going this morning?
I'm good, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm so excited and overwhelmed to talk to you today about stuttering modification treatment. So, Joe, are you ready to tackle this bad boy?
I think so. This is a huge topic. I mean, it's a huge sort of unwieldy topic, but I'm happy to do so.
Well, the goal today is to tell the listeners every possible thing about stuttering modification. So we got a lot of work ahead of us. And obviously we're not going to do that. And in fact, Joe, is it safe to say we put together a reference list for this show of articles, chapters, and books that we reviewed, but it's safe to say we're not going to discuss all of them on air in-depthly, but we're going to pick from a few and just let the readers know how we prepped and what they can read more. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that sounds good to me anyway.
All right. So let's just remind everyone that Dr. Joseph Klein is a person who stutters, a speech-language pathologist, and an assistant professor in Appalachian State University's Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders. I'd like to thank, at the top of the show here, the Stutter Talk Advisory Council, because so many of them made great recommendations of books and chapters to read for this show. I was able to discuss some of the topics for the show ahead of time, so I just want to thank those good folks, Luke Danil, Walter Manning, Judy Custer, and others. All right, Joe, enough of the intros. Let's start the show by each defining or describing in about 60 seconds each what stuttering modification is. Do you want to go first?
All right. So with stuttering modification therapy, you know, that really comes to me, it really comes from Charles Van Riper. And he was really concerned with having his clients being able to modify moments of stuttering, them being able to reduce their fear of stuttering, and also to be able to eliminate any kind of avoidance behaviors that they had. So, you know, always talking when and where and who they wanted to talk to. And, you know, he used to use terms like easy stuttering, being able to stutter fluently. So just having, you know, being able to have moments of stuttering, but not, you know, to get to the point that you've modified them so that they're just really tiny, quick, easy moments of stuttering.
Wow, you did that much briefer than I could have. So let me define stuttering modification as I did on a recent show with Jay Prakash Sunda. So actually, Luke Danil, a Stutter Talk advisor, he mentioned, I think, a really important point where he said that stuttering modification is, quote, a conceptual approach to stuttering intervention rather than a specific treatment. So when we're talking today about stuttering modification, we're not talking about one way to do things. We're talking about an idea, and different speech pathologists will use stuttering modification in different ways. So I have it down as two main points. So approach rather than avoid stuttering, and stuttering easily. So for approaching stuttering, it would be things like voluntary stuttering, allowing yourself to stutter openly, talking about stuttering with other people, and advertising stuttering. So telling others in some way that you stutter, like, hi, my name is Peter, and I'm a stutterer. And then the stuttering easily would be pull-outs, like I'm showing you now, where I get stuck in a stutter, and I just work through it. Cancellations, like I just showed the listeners, where I stutter through the word, pause for a second or two, and then say it with an easier stutter. And preparatory sets, where if you anticipate stuttering, you can prepare to stutter with a light context. So if I anticipate stuttering on my name, Peter, I can prepare to put my lips together lightly, Peter, and then say it with an easy stutter because I already know the stutter's coming. So it's like a preemptive strike. Do you think we're on the same page here, Joe?
I do. Absolutely. I mean, like you said, we could talk forever about what it is and exactly how to do it. So, yeah, I think we're definitely on the same page.
So, Joe, you know, what I'd like to do just at the top of the show here is play a really short clip from Stutter Talk episode 300, which featured David Mitchell, the author of Black Swan Green. And in it, in this clip, it's only 7 seconds long. David Mitchell talks about, well, the importance of talking about stuttering. So let's give a quick listen.
If we discussed it exactly never, then that policy helped me exactly not at all.
So what we heard David Mitchell say was, if we discussed it, stuttering, exactly never, then that policy helped me exactly not at all. And I love that. And, you know, maybe you have to tell me if you think I've got this right or not, but when I think of stuttering modification treatment or the approach, and I get it confused a lot, I think, with self-help, because to me they're so similar. And I really think that self-help and stuttering modification are based on this idea that we're talking openly about stuttering. And when we're not talking openly about stuttering, we're missing something huge. Do you think that's a stretch, or you think that is the basis of stuttering modification?
Well, no, I think that's a huge part of modification, and really, it's probably most of the desensitization part of it. You know, if you're looking also at, you know, we talked about different ways to talk about stuttering modification, but you can also look at it as having sort of three main phases of identification, desensitization, and modification. And it's really the talking about it that is honestly what most of the identification and the desensitization is. It's being able to talk about it openly, being able to talk about it like it's anything else. And, you know, how can you really understand something unless you're able to talk about it? So, you know, to me, I think you're totally right. I think that's a huge part of stuttering modification, is being able to talk openly and easily about your stuttering and just about stuttering in general.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'd even say that during the modification aspects of treatment too, we're doing a lot of talking about stuttering, because if you are trying to figure out how to work through a word that's hard for you, you know, I've had so many clients say to me, what do you think I should do? How can I pull out of that word? And, you know, so it's a real open conversation.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, and I know that recently you had Walt Manning on the show, who's one of my favorites, and he always says, you know, you can't work on stuttering unless you work on stuttering, and you kind of put it up on the table and really work on it. And so, you know, I think that's really what he's talking about, is if you're not talking about stuttering, if you're not working on stuttering, well, you know, I'm not sure what you're doing exactly.
we're starting off the show, we're making it clear we're talking about stuttering modification. Do you think it's fair to say that we're basically placing that up against fluency shaping, like they're almost rivals, or do you see it a different way?
To me, what I usually do in my grad class on stuttering, we'll have one class where we just compare fluency shaping and stuttering modification. And on the parts in stuttering modification where we get to like the preparatory sets, you know, if the students are paying attention, they'll be like, well, wait a minute, isn't that an easy onset? And isn't that light contact? And isn't that, you know, all these other fluency shaping goals? And we'll talk about how, yes, you know, a lot of what you end up seeing as far as the quote unquote product from both of these therapies should end up looking pretty similar, in that if I'm really preparing and thinking that I'm going to have some moments of stuttering, or even to throw in some stuttering or some easy stuttering, all right, this should sound a lot like easy onsets and light articulatory contacts, and it should end up sounding a lot alike. So to me, the big difference between the two really is in the mindset, where you're talking about stuttering and you're working on stuttering, whereas in fluency shaping, you're really working on fluency. But I think that there are lots of ways where these two sort of therapy paradigms really end up blending together.
Yeah, and when we discussed fluency shaping on episode 309, we did this thing on air where I modeled a tool and we tried to figure out, well, which one was it? And it was both. It was fluency shaping and stuttering modification.
Yeah, absolutely. And voluntary stuttering, if you want to make that something different from modification, although I think lots of people use voluntary stuttering certainly as part of stuttering modification too.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Now, there's so many places to take this show. Let's listen to one more clip. This will be a clip with Jay Prakash Sunda from India, and it was episode 324. And he talks about how stuttering modification actually led to him having a lot more fluency. So let's give a quick listen.
We used to go out to schools. We used to do presentations on stuttering, and we had a SLP also. So he used to arrange group speech therapy sessions. It was at that time that I had started using bouncing. For 6 continuous months, I did it. There was a time after a few months that I was asked to go and approach schools on my own, talk to principals, talk to teachers. As I was doing it on a continuous basis, like unintentionally, I became so open about my stutter by talking about it at so many schools with so many teachers and children, and by bouncing a lot, that there was an increase in fluency. Right now also, I'm willing to stammer openly. I'm willing to go into a block. I'm willing to be in a situation where there may not be any sound coming out. I'm willing to be in a situation where I may not be able to say something the way I would want to say it. So I'm willing to be in all such situations. So that is why I'm having I'm more comfortable now, and more comfort and more peace, I think, brings more fluency.
Okay, so Joe, what we heard JP say was things like, I'm willing to go into a block. I'm willing to be in a situation where there may not be any sound coming out. And then he ends by saying, he has more comfort and more peace, and he thinks it brings more fluency. Does that surprise you?
You know, it doesn't surprise me at all. You know, the kind of therapy that I do with clients I see is probably most like a stuttering modification therapy. And one thing I'll tell them is, if we're doing this right, in the short term, you'll have a lot more stuttering because you'll be learning about your stuttering, you'll be thinking about your stuttering, you'll be focused on your stuttering, and you're going to have more of it. But after that short term, it's going to start a lot of that stuttering, and especially a lot of the severe, the hard stuttering, is going to start falling away as you try to stutter, as you stop pushing so hard and you let some of those moments of stuttering just kind of come through and, you know, you stop struggling with it. And one thing that Van Riper talks a lot about is that, you know, so much of what we do when we're stuttering is we're trying not to stutter. And that once you can start to unravel a lot of the trying not to stutter, you're gonna end up with a lot more fluency just because you're not trying to do all this extra stuff that is so difficult.
Well, you know, I think that very naturally brings us to just one more clip I want to play, at least for right now. We recently had Phil Schneider on the show, which was episode 325, and I think he makes a similar point. So let's give a quick listen.
So the voluntary stuttering says to people, I think it's going to be very helpful in your journey to actually take this thing which scares you and bring it right out there. And when you stick your head in the tiger's mouth, when you go to the place that scares you the most, which is counterintuitive, it frequently liberates you from the fear.
So Joe, you know, Phil said some neat things. He said that when you stick your head in the tiger's mouth, when you go to the place that scares you the most, which is counterintuitive, it frequently liberates you from the fear, from the fear of speaking. And I think that's something you just said too. When you're able to reduce that fear and stay in the moment of stuttering, you're able to focus on modifying and working through the stutter and these preemptive strikes we're talking about. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's so interesting to me too that both Dr. Schneider and then JP were both talking about sort of the liberation from stuttering. And just, you know, for me, in kind of preparing for the show and thinking about the show, I was looking at some old Van Riper, and you know, he talks about seeking relief from the tyranny of fears and frustration. So, you know, you get that liberation from the tyranny of just being, you know, being so worried about stuttering and so upset about stuttering all the time. And the show that you had on previously with JP, where he's talking about, you know, even just trying to go to lunch and you're not only really worried about talking while you're having lunch with people, but you're worried about what you're going to order for lunch and if you're going to be able to say what you want for lunch. And there's so much just worry and fear, and just, you know, being okay with that and throwing in, and he called it bouncing, where he would have just some nice easy bounces where you and I might be more likely to work on things like voluntary stuttering or to talk about it as voluntary stuttering. But, you know, it's really similar things. And just being okay with your stuttering, being okay with how you sound, being okay with, you know, having some stuttering can be so freeing, and it can be so relaxing, and just it's kind of like taking the piano off your back and being okay with how you sound and how you stutter. And I hope that wasn't too long, but.
No, I was really enjoying that. You could have kept going. And I'm so glad you brought up that JP clip. So I'm just going to play it right now so the listeners can hear him talking about those points.
So previously, like, I was always anxious. I was always afraid. Like, I became a very timid person. it was very hard to live that way. It was like if I had a meeting after lunch, it would be very hard to eat the lunch. So it was like that. And then when you're ordering lunch, that itself was very stressful. Like, you will think, what do you want to eat? And then you will think, will I be able to say it? But after stuttering modification, if I wanted to eat something and if I knew that I may stammer on that word, what I would do is I would go and stammer on my own. I would do it anyhow. And if I had a call after lunch, I knew that I am going to stammer, and it's okay to stammer. So I would enjoy my lunch.
So Joe, we can't describe every stuttering modification approach or program, but why don't we talk about one that's very well known, the successful stuttering management program known as the SSMP. Could you start us off on that?
You actually probably know even more than, well, I know that you know more than I do about the SSMP because you've actually worked there as a clinician. But the successful stuttering management program is a residential intensive stuttering modification treatment program that's been offered up at Eastern Washington University for almost 50 years now. And the SSMP really focuses on, you know, things that we've been talking about in stuttering modification. And so it's an intensive program that usually lasts about 3 weeks, and it's really similar to therapies of both Van Riper and Sheehan. About the first half of the therapy, so phase one of the therapy really targets developing a better understanding of stuttering, eliminating and reducing escape and avoidance behaviors, and identification of your own stuttering pattern. And so it really is a lot of, you know, just doing open stuttering and being very aware of your stuttering and stuttering very openly. And then the remainder of the program is really learning techniques to manage your stuttering. So things like you were talking about with cancellations, with pullouts, with voluntary stuttering, and then really working on being able to transfer these techniques out into the real world. And then also just working on, right, how do you keep this going? Because one of the biggest challenges for all of the intensive programs, whether it's modification or fluency focused, is really on, all right, how do you keep up what you're practicing once you leave therapy? So in a nutshell, to me, that's what the SMP is.
Yeah, just to give listeners a little bit more of that flavor. I mean, we've said that the SSMP, the Successful Stuttering Management Program, is just one example of a stuttering modification approach, but it's a boot camp for stutterers. I mean, you get off you get off the plane, you have dinner, you wake up, and you go to your first session, which is a group therapy session. So, you know, you meet in a room, and every person who stutters has two therapists, two graduate student clinicians. There are one or more certified speech language pathologists there. When I was a student clinician in the program, when they had one at the University of Utah, it was run by Tom Gerster, an ASHA certified speech language pathologist, and he took us right out into the university And he went and we did what we called surveys. So you go up to a student, a random student, and you have a piece of paper with questions on it about stuttering. And you say to the student, hi, my name is Peter. I'm a person who stutters. I'm working on my speech. Can I ask you some questions about stuttering? And then you talk to them. Most of the people stop and most of the people are happy to talk to you. And I can say that from experience because I've done it in Utah and I've done it in New York City too. So people, now more people will stop in Utah, but they do stop. So, and you know, the whole point of that is to show yourself and the listener that it's okay to talk about stuttering. And at some point you're going to start to work on speech tools while doing this, but you're really letting your stuttering out. And you could do this 50, 100, 200 times during the course of the SSMP. It very quickly becomes a little competitive where it's like, this is what I need to do to get better. So I'm going to really do it and I'm going to try to get more than the person next to me. And you can imagine it's very startling. It's like jumping into a cold pool because you think to yourself, am I really doing this? Is everybody else really? Is this okay?
Right.
So, I mean, I can't remember exactly, but I think we did things like that for about a week or a week and a half. And then the second half of the program are working on the controls, the pullouts, the cancellations, the preparatory sets, the easy stuttering. And as memory serves, the term fluency or the absence of stuttering, as I like to say it, isn't really coming up. We're talking about stuttering well. So a very Van Riperen stuttering modification approach. You're just going out there, you're stuttering. I mean, I think it got to the point, Joe, where people were walking through neighborhoods and knocking on doors saying, I'm a stutterer working on my stuttering. Can I talk to you about stuttering?
Wow.
And, you know, in retrospect, I'm not sure if that was necessary, but it's really like it's putting it out there. So I think we should bring up the point that you've alluded to, which is relapse. And isn't it true, Joe, for that any treatment approach, relapse is a huge, huge part of what to expect?
Yes, absolutely. And what's hard is that we don't really have great data on how many people relapse in different therapies, but we certainly know that lots of people relapse in most therapies. And to me, one of the reasons why we've got a lot more research in the quote unquote fluency shaping therapies is that, you know, I might not be able to use my fluency shaping strategies all the time, but I could use them in the therapy room. I could use them, let's say my therapist called me, and I could use them, and I could be 100% fluent for a while. And so, wow, we've got this data on, right, 100% fluency for this person after therapy, 6 months after therapy, a year after therapy. But that person might not really be talking like that at any time, other than when they're talking to their therapist or if they're in some kind of therapy group with people who've gone through the same kind of therapy. And right. What's hard for programs like the Successful Stuttering Management Program is, like you're saying, you're learning to stutter really well. And so you may not show these great improvements 6 months later, a year later, a year and a half later, although I'd be willing to bet the way you're talking then to your therapist and to whoever is doing the research is probably much more like the way you're really talking all the time, number one. And then also, just like we were saying, a big part of the success of either of these therapies will be, you know, what are you able to do after the therapy's over? And, you know, to me, you know, I've never been a part of the SSMP program. However, you know, just from what I know about it and from lots of people who have gone through it, I really am a fan of the program because, like you were saying, I think it helps people to stop being so afraid of their stuttering and to enter into more situations and to feel much more free to do whatever they want to do regardless of whether they stutter or not. And to me, that, as a therapist, that's the biggest success we can have, is if our clients really go on to have the job they want to have the relationship they want to have, order the food they want to have, to be able to give presentations in class that they're having, right? That, to me, is a success rather than, you know, how many times a client may or may not have stuttered in the therapy room.
Wow, Joe, if I had an audio highlighter, I would be highlighting all of what you just said. Just great, great points. And, you know, I asked you about relapse, which is kind of a loaded question because, well, what are we relapsing from? I mean, a great example of that is the person I knew at the SSMP, the client, who came in doing everything he could to hide his stuttering. And he, I don't know if it was that first day or the first 2 days where he had only a handful of stutters. And several days in, and you know, one of the cool things about the SSMP is we do things like tally or count stutters. So you have a stutter and you actually take a moment to note it, to write it down, you know, just make a notch on a piece of paper. And one day he came back utterly exhausted from a day of working in public on his speech. Like, that's the great thing, is you're going out. There's some time spent in the clinic room, but you're going out into the real world, to malls, to university stores, and you're stuttering out there. And he came back with hundreds of stutters that he had notated. And he was exhausted emotionally and physically because he hadn't allowed himself to stutter in so long. So how do you relapse from that?
Right.
You know, so he's doing what he needs to do. So if you're going to measure that with a day, the last day of the SSMP, well, you could measure it when he's still allowing himself to be open about stuttering. You could measure it when he's worked so hard and he's having a lot of reduced struggle because he's really faced his fears. But you know, you're going to have to work really hard on both of those things, on keeping the covert behaviors at bay, sort of avoiding avoidance, as we say, but also allowing yourself to face your stuttering in an unfearful way so you can reduce your struggle. I feel like I just said a lot there. So let's just remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk with Dr. Joseph Klein, assistant professor at Appalachian State University. So let's talk about the research for the SSMP in just a moment. But first, let's listen to a recent clip from Stutter Talk with Nora O'Connor. That was episode 323, where she talks about her experience at the SSMP.
It has always been about... how was I going to live with my stuttering? I think what allowed the SSMP to work in my life, or even just imagining attending or the program, was that I was going to gain tools to live successfully as a person who stuttered. And as a result of that, a lot of the stuttering behaviors did reduce, but that certainly wasn't the focus or the reason why I was attracted to... No, I take that back, Peter. As much as it was attractive to learn how to live successfully with my stuttering, I did desire to not have to struggle with communicating. And so if I went to the SSMP and I was able to rid myself of all of my stuttering behaviors, I would have welcomed that in.
Can you share with us one really powerful thing about your experience there? And if you have one, maybe something that I don't want to say was negative, but something you thought was lacking in the program, or something you thought could have been helpful?
Oh, Peter, to even go put the word negative with the SSMP, it would be very hard to even begin to conceptualize that. Probably one of the happiest periods in my life was those three and a half weeks. It was more than what a support group was able to offer. It was more than if I was going to hour of speech therapy a week, that being bathed in the love and the support of so many beautiful people, beginning to believe that I could be successful in my life. Yeah, it was a powerful experience.
So, you know, Joe, what really struck me about that, well, a couple things struck me. She talked about being bathed in the love and support of so many beautiful people.
Right.
And reviewing Van Riper this morning, he also talked about the importance of being bathed in stuttering. And I think it's interesting when the person who designed stuttering modification and a client can have, and who have never spoken, can have a similar understanding. I think that's kind of neat. Now, were you surprised when Nora had said, you know, she said there was nothing negative at all about the program, but then she sort of said, but I still wanted to be fluent. I don't know if she said those words, but I thought it was a really honest moment.
Well, absolutely. And really, Nora's whole podcast was one huge honest moment. And it was really fantastic. And, you know, I think that's really true, that there's always a part of people who stutter, at least for a long time, saying, you know, gosh, it would be so nice to just be fluent. And yet at the same time, I think depending on where the person is, you quickly realize how important things like group support and like just really stuttering and allowing yourself to do the one thing that you've always tried not to, which is stutter and stutter and stutter in a really supportive, open environment, can just be fantastic. And just in listening to what Nora said, that's really what she needed at that point, was not only to be able to work on her stuttering, but just real self-acceptance. And to me, that's certainly what therapies like the SSMP really bring to the table.
Yeah, and as we're talking about the evidence for the SSMP and other stuttering modification approaches, this reminds me of when I had Bruce Wampold on Stutter Talk, and he said, well, outcomes, that's your evidence. You know, how did people do? And when you talk to people like Nora, who attended the SSMP, it seems that most of the people I know who I've spoken to seem to have overwhelmingly positive experiences, and not only positive, but I think, as you said earlier, you know, are you doing the things that you weren't doing before?
Right, right. Absolutely. I think one thing that could be hard for people like you and I, who are really involved in the stuttering support movement, though, too, is that, you know, I have no doubt that there are people who go through fluency shaping therapy who become really fluent and who then don't have a need to come to stuttering support or to listen to stutter talk. However, I would argue that those people are probably in the minority, and so it's the people who went through the fluency shaping therapies and they didn't work at all, and those people are able to tell really compelling stories about how and why the fluency shaping therapies didn't work for them. And then people who we know, you know, who have gone to programs like the SSMP, you know, I haven't ever heard somebody who went to SSMP come back and say anything negative about it. It's always been really positive in that, you know, they've learned so much about themselves, so much about stuttering, and they've gotten some great group support along the way.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I do think that I've met some people, I met some people who've gone back to take the course again, so they solved something in it that they wanted to repeat. And I do think I've met one, maybe two people who just weren't ready for it, so they didn't really take full advantage of it. So when everybody else was stuttering very openly, they were still very resistant to it. So I do think if you end up there and you're just not ready to dive in, yeah, it could be problematic.
No, that's a good point. I think, and too, if you go there expecting fluency and still working on fluency, that's just not what you're going to get. So I think that is a good point.
So there have been several studies on the SSMP, and there's two major studies, or the most prominent studies, that I think we should talk about now. There was the Michael Blomgren and colleagues study from 2005 with 19 participants or subjects. And then there was the Jim, you'll have to help me say his name. I don't even know how to say his last name.
Shamasaurus, I believe, although I'm not sure either.
So we'll do our best. Jim Shamasaurus and Kim Krieger from 2010, they had 18 subjects or participants, so almost the same. Can you walk us through the Blomgren and colleagues study from 2005? Like, what were the major findings that we should talk about now?
Yeah, absolutely. What the Blomgren and colleagues were really looking at, they were looking at percent syllable stuttered. They were looking at scores on the stuttering severity instrument, as well as factors like struggle, avoidance, expectancy, and then anxiety scores as well. And what they really found is that with long-term follow-up, they did not find any reductions in stuttering frequency or severity. And so their article as a whole was really more of an article suggesting that the SSMP really, in a long-term basis, wasn't very helpful for people who stutter overall.
And what were the major findings of the Samosaurus and Krieger study from 2010 with almost the same amount of participants?
Yeah, what they were really able to do was to take people who had gone through therapy and at SSMP and their findings were suggestive of changes in both fluency and in attitudes about stuttering. Their findings were certainly much more positive in suggesting that the SSMP did really show some lasting changes for their clients.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting when you have two studies with on the same treatment program with different subjects, of course, with different findings. I can imagine it's a little frustrating, well, for me and for the listeners and for just about anybody who's looking at this and saying, well, if one study says X and one study says Y, what have we learned?
Right.
I don't know
right.
if there's an answer to that.
So here's where I think we need to start looking at individual outcomes. So, you know, being able to look at the individual data of each person who went through the therapy and not only looking at their outcome measures as far as percent syllable stuttered and scores on attitudes and feelings and quality of life questionnaires, but also really doing some qualitative interviews to really try to find out what worked for them and also why they think things either worked or different or did not work. And, you know, one thing we've been talking about with stuttering modification is, you know, it's not really a very specific therapy where you do step one and then you move on to step two and then on to step three. It is a little bit more unwieldy. And so, you know, to me, being able to look at therapy from an individual perspective and maybe getting some more qualitative outcomes might be a lot more meaningful than just looking at the numbers we get after therapy.
I think that's a really, really great point. I know we talked about this recently when I saw you at a stuttering workshop, and in Nan Bernstein Ratner's new video, it just came out through the Stuttering Foundation, she talks about this topic too. And Nan was making the point that the individual case study is such a high level of evidence, and that for some reason, well, I think reasons we understand, the field of speech pathology has sort of, you know, some folks in our field have gotten it in their heads that you need these large trials where you're looking at 18, 20, 50, 100 people, when in fact, looking at what helps one person is really valuable. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it is. And, you know, I think too, especially if a lot of us who do this kind of therapy can put together case studies so that if I have two or three clients and you have two or three clients and different people around the country have a few clients, you know, we can end up getting a fairly large N of, you know, a pretty similar kinds of therapy, so that we not only have the very individualized data, but then you could also pool all those clients together to end up with the more traditional studies that our field, I think, tends to weight more highly, even though there's not necessarily a reason for them to be weighted more highly.
Yeah. Let me pull out some of the interesting findings, I think, that CM and Soros and Krieger found in their 2010 study. So they looked at, so for frequency, duration, and physical concomitance of stuttering, the overt behaviors, just like you said, they found there was a significant decrease in these beat behaviors 12 months after therapy ended. But they also found an interesting positive outcome regarding speech rate, and they found, quote, as a byproduct of avoidance reduction in stuttering modification therapy, speech rate appeared to normalize for the participants. Now that's really interesting. By going through this program, by facing their fears of stuttering, by modifying their stuttering, their speech rate became naturalized. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I do think that people who go through these programs, you know, they do tend to have more natural sounding speech, you know, even if they do have some stuttering thrown in. So, yeah, that's not surprising to me at all.
They also found that the speakers' communication attitudes also started to normalize, which I think is really interesting, where they started feeling a lot better about their ability to communicate after going through the successful stuttering management program. And that's one of the outcomes that we want, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really, you know, what programs like this are designed for is, you know, are you going out and speaking and not avoiding and speaking really well and saying what you want to say and doing what you want to do, whether or not you stutter. I mean, that's really the goal of the SSMP, and it's the goal of a lot of us. And so, yeah, to me, the findings that the clients were able to do that and were able to feel okay about their stuttering and were able to, you know, go out and say what they want to say, that wasn't surprising, and it's a good thing.
So I sent Jim Ciamasaurus an email saying to him, you know, why do you think your findings were different from Blomgren and colleagues? And I'm going to read you. He gave me permission to read his response on air. So he wrote, in terms of your question regarding our severity findings relative to Blomgren et al., I don't have a clear answer for you. I wonder if it was the luck of the draw or if there were more avoiders in the Blomgren study and the pretreatment overt severity was influenced by avoidance. Therefore, they tried to hide their stuttering, which translated to lower overt severity scores. Keep in mind that this is pure speculation on my part. One thing is certain, we need more people to study the benefits of stuttering modification. Now that's really interesting, right?
That absolutely is, in that, you know, if you have a, you know, depending on who's evaluating you too, you might be more or less likely to actually avoid during the evaluation, and so you wouldn't show a lot of stuttering. So, you know, that is really interesting.
Joe, do you have any final thoughts or comments on the SSMP before we take a break and come on back and discuss a little bit more of the research?
I guess just that what we have been saying is that so often the most important factors in life or in stuttering are the factors that are the hardest to evaluate easily. You know, it's pretty – well, it's actually kind of hard to count moments of stuttering, but it's certainly a lot easier to do that than it is to look at things like people's attitudes and how often they talk when they'd like to talk. So, you know, I think one thing that's really good about programs like the SSMP is that it really – makes people in the field think about, well, how are we evaluating success in therapy? And that it can't just be about simply moments of stuttering. It has to be about more than that, because stuttering and talking and communicating are about a lot more than that too.
Well, that gives us the perfect place to play a short clip from Jane Fraser from just the previous episode from 328, where I think she echoes a similar point to the one that you just made.
Does anybody really think that Van Riper continued his therapy thinking that he was doing the wrong thing and that he didn't have evidence that what he was doing was working? We know that Charles Van Riper was able to help a tremendous number of people. I honestly don't think he was sitting around counting syllables.
So that's kind of what you just said, right, that, you know, Van Riper, who's often considered the founder of stuttering modification, and to this day, you know, those of us who really believe in stuttering modification, whether it's integrated or used alone, that it's really not about just counting stuttering moments to define success.
Right, exactly. It's really about a lot more than that. We do, however, have to come up with, and I think we are really just now starting to be able to come up with much better ways of evaluating success in therapy, because, you know, as a professional field, that is what we have to do. So, you know, it is important to have the outcomes, but it's also important to remember that if we're just counting moments of stuttering, that often isn't the most important outcome to be measuring when it comes to people who stutter.
Just to add to that, and of course I agree with you completely on that, just from my personal experience, the more I stuttered, the happier I became, you know. Now, as you said earlier in the show, you know, and then the more I stuttered at some point, the less I stuttered.
Right, right.
But I got to tell you, man, I had years of stuttering more, not weeks or months. But if somebody would have measured me 2 years into speech therapy, they might have seen more stuttering than 2 years before.
That's so important. I mean, that's such an important point, because just like we've been saying, if people are talking more and saying what they want to say, it's so, you know, you're going to get more stuttering, at least in the shorter, moderate term, either half a year, 1 year, 2 years. You know, if you're saying what you want to say, how you want to say it, you're going to get stuttering. Whereas if you're just focused on your speech and just focused on being fluent, you know, I could be pretty uninteresting and not be able to think of a lot of important things to say right now, but we could both sit here and be fluent for an hour if we wanted to, but that's often not very helpful.
I totally agree. So we've been talking a long time. Let's take a quick break and come on back for some more stuttering modification.
Stutter Talk is a 501c3 charitable organization and is listener supported. Make your tax-deductible contribution today by going to StutterTalk.com and clicking on that yellow donate button. Do your part to keep StutterTalk thriving.
Yo, 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 what's up, y'all? This is Taro from Our Time, and you are listening to the hottest station in town, Stutter Talk.
Hi, folks, I'm Mel Tittis, and you're listening to Stutter Talk.
I was searching for something I could not describe.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Stutter Talk for this Stuttering Modification Extravaganza show, also known as Sitting Shiva for Fluency. Sorry. Bad joke, sorry. I think we'll get in trouble for that joke, I'm sure. Alright, so I am Peter Reitzes here with Dr. Joseph Klein, being so generous with your time today, Joe. Thank you. We got a couple more studies to talk about. I mean, there's so many studies we could talk about, but we don't have time to talk about them all. So let's talk about a study from 1999 by Manning, Burleson, and Thaxton. And I'm just going to read the very major finding. Quote, listeners rated this. Oh, so what they did was they got listeners to listen to people who stutter using a stuttering modification tool, or just stuttering. So, quote, listeners rated the speaker using the cancellation and pullout techniques as being significantly more handicapped than when he was stuttering only. Isn't that interesting? What do you make of it?
Well, you know, it does make a lot of sense. I mean, you know, there aren't a lot of people who stutter who love going out and doing cancellations where you have to stutter and then pause and then go through another stutter. And it is very, it feels very unnatural to the speaker and to the listener. And, you know, in a way, what Van Riper wanted was for people to be able to use the cancellation and the pullout really as a bridge to being able to have more of a easy stutter or a preparatory set kind of stuttering where you're having very minimal moments of stuttering. And I think especially the cancellation was supposed to be very desensitizing because it's not comfortable or easy to do, and so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't surprise me that listeners also feel less comfortable with that, and it just takes that extra time. Whereas, you know, I believe that most listeners don't really care about people who stutter. I don't think they care about what they're stuttering sounds like. I think it bothers the person who stutters a lot more than it bothers most listeners. And so to me, it's not surprising that listeners would have more of a reaction to stuttering plus modification than just to somebody just normally stuttering.
It makes sense. But I also have the sense, just from my own personal experience, that listeners also have been positive about noticing that I've been working on my stuttering. But that also goes to the research a bit, I think, too, because they might have seen me stuttering being out of control a little bit. And then when they see me stuttering in a very controlled manner where I'm showing people I'm working on it, I do believe that it's also been positive at times. But, you know, you brought up a really interesting point about how Van Riper expected that a cancellation would be used for a short time. And I think that point gets lost sometimes because you'll meet stutterers who have been using cancellations for a dozen or more years. They've incorporated it as a regular speaking strategy, which is fine. But it is a very noticeable. So, you know, if you're regularly introducing yourself as Peter, Peter writes this, I mean, that's very noticeable. And as you said, I'm not sure Van Riper intended it to be something you use regularly.
Right. And really, he was using that as a punishment, because if he wanted people to be able to move towards being able to throw in some much easier stuttering, and that if you had a longer moment of stuttering, you then had to stop, you had to pause, and then you had to say it again. And so, you know, it really was, okay, I'm not going to do that again. You know, I'm going to make sure I catch it and pull out, or I'm going to slide through it right from the beginning and stutter like Dr. Van Riper would have wanted me to stutter from the very beginning, so I don't have to do this horrible cancellation again. You know, now having said that, having done, you know, I've probably only done a handful of cancellations in my life, but I've found those to be tremendously desensitizing when I have done them. It's like, oh, you know, I can do that, and people still have to listen to me. So, you know, I do think it does definitely have value as a speaking tool, but yeah, I've never had a client go out and do a cancellation as an assignments, mostly because I think most clients you say they do actually just make that up and don't actually do them because they're so hard to do outside of the therapy room.
You just put so many interesting things on the table. I have to tell you, I've done many, many cancellations over the years in public. And for the, you know, as you said, Van Riper meant it as a self-inflicted punishment, where you stutter on a word and you know, you race through it. And Van Riper didn't want us rewarding ourselves for hard stutters. He wanted us rewarding ourselves for easy stutters. So I'll just give one more example of a cancellation to show people what Van Riper was getting at. So if you were to do a cancellation on the word pizza, so you say, I'd like a slice of pepperoni pizza and a large Coke. Well, he wanted you to move on from the soft stutter, not from the hard stutter. So I think Van Riper, you know, had a pretty good idea there. But I think many of us might use modified cancellation. So if I have a stutter to this day in public that I don't like, I might just say it again just to show myself and the listener that I don't have to say it so hard. Which I think is getting more away from a punishment and more just like, I don't want to stutter that hard. I want to stutter better than
right,
that.
Right, absolutely, absolutely.
This study from 1999, the Manning and colleague study, what they said, which is really interesting, is they're not saying we shouldn't do stuttering modification tools because some of the listeners might not like it. I think their point is this should prepare a therapist to prepare a client for what they're going to be in for.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, like we said, it's not surprising that if you're doing either cancellation or even if you're doing, you know, I'm sure for the study they would have to do really obvious pullouts so that, you know, you could, the listener would know that it was a pullout and not just, you know, easing through a word or something, so that when they stuttered would probably be something like that, whereas just having somebody stutter through something might be more easy to do. And again, you know, if you're working really hard at your speech and you're doing extra things, I think it's just going to be more noticeable to the listener, and that's certainly okay. And I am all for, you know, there are times when it's okay to make your listeners feel uncomfortable. That is, to me, that has to be at least a little part of what you're doing in therapy, you know, but just to know that as you're doing some of these techniques, that, you know, it's going to be more noticeable than just doing regular old stuttering.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, what a pullout did for me, and I have to say that using a pullout, working through a stutter while I was having one, has and continues to be one of my major ways to deal with this issue. And what it really did for me was to give me the confidence to know that I could stutter and get through it and communicate effectively. So, you know, if somebody doesn't necessarily like the way a pullout sounds, that's okay, and I can be prepared for that. But for me, the sound of a pullout's a lot better than silence and avoiding and choosing a career because I don't want to stutter. You know, doing all those, like changing the food order at a restaurant, not calling up a girl for a date because I don't want her to hear me stutter. I'd much rather do what I want to do and stutter and work through the stutter than avoid all those things. Because, you know, I did that for 21 plus years and I didn't want to do it anymore.
Oh, absolutely. And to me, it's also really important because if you, you know, sometimes you'll work with clients who have only gone through a fluency shaping kind of therapy, and that's been helpful to a certain extent, but then they say, you know, when I stutter, what do I do? Because I've always worked on trying to be fluent, but then I have no idea what to do when I actually stutter. And, you know, being able to teach a client how to do a pullout and how to move through a moment of stuttering really easily and really gently can give, like you said, gives you the power to say, if I get into a moment of stuttering, I can get out of that moment of stuttering, and it's okay, and I can move forward and keep going. And so even if it might make a listener momentarily uncomfortable, it's, to me, it's very important.
Let's remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk. Peter Wright is here with Dr. Joseph Klein, and you're being just so awesomely generous with your time, Joe. And you know, there's so many things to throw in. I mean, we have to at least very briefly mention the wonderful research that's been done through the National Stuttering Association studies. Some of that research is published. Some of that research is in review. But, I mean, they found so many interesting things that support the use of stuttering modification. Let me just throw out a few. So one of the findings in these studies, one by McClure and Yaris, and again, these are all going to be in the reference section for this episode, episode 329, they found that of the people surveyed, 81% of people who stutter report avoiding speaking situations to avoid stuttering. So we know that people who, now we don't need a study to tell us that, but we know, but we know that a lot of people who are seeking help, the majority of people it seems that are seeking help for their stuttering are people who avoid stuttering and avoid speaking. So doesn't it make sense that a therapy approach like stuttering modification, which directly targets avoidance, well, is just that. It makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I think a lot of therapists who don't work a lot with people who stutter is what they forget is that, you know, I can be completely fluent during a situation or when ordering food or whatever, but that doesn't mean that I've said anything like what I wanted to say. And so having that avoidance, knowing that clients are doing that avoidance, and then what is it that we're working on in therapy to help our clients avoid less and to approach what they want to say and how they want to say it more is a huge part, I think, of really good stuttering therapy.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. Another interesting finding from these National Stuttering Association studies. There was one by Yaris, Quisel, and Murphy in 2002, and they had about 200 subjects. And here's a quote from the study. The majority of respondents indicated that the most appropriate goals for both children and adults were to address feelings and attitudes about stuttering, regardless of any change in fluency. The majority of respondents. Now, again, it's a survey of people who participate in a self-help organization. So it is a certain group, but I think that's a really important finding that people who stutter are saying, I want to talk about stuttering. It's not just about fluency for me.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're so upset about your stuttering and trying so hard not to stutter, working on your fluency doesn't ever make you less afraid of stuttering. So that even if you get to a point that you're really pretty fluent, if you haven't dealt with those attitudes and feelings about stuttering, you're always going to have that fear and that anxiety about stuttering. And to me, that's why we see a lot of relapse in therapy, because people are, you know, even though I can be fluent for a little while, in the back of my mind, I'm so afraid that I'm going to have these big moments of stuttering still. And so it's just, it's huge to work on those attitudes and feelings.
Yeah. And sort of the flip side of the coin of what you just said is that focusing so much on fluency may make the fears greater or worse, or make the problem more distant. I know the more I tried to not stutter and to avoid stuttering, the more stuttering was just a taboo. It couldn't be discussed. I couldn't acknowledge it. I couldn't touch it. I couldn't look at it. I mean, literally, I was unable to objectively look at my stuttering for my first 21, 22 years. And it was so relieving to be able to look at my stuttering, to touch it, as Jane Fraser has said, to touch the hot stove, you know, and to allow myself to really dive in and make some changes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's huge.
Let me bring up one other point from those National Stuttering Association surveys. There's one in review now where they looked at 717 teens and adults who stutter. And one of the major findings was that people who stutter who involved in self-help are, quote, less likely to avoid speaking situations and less likely to say their stuttering interferes with work or school. Now, I know that stuttering modification isn't technically self-help, but I think it's along the same lines. And I'd venture to say that the people I know who have been involved in stuttering modification, in talking about stuttering, often in group therapy contexts, are people who are avoiding less and doing what they want to do more at work and at school.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so amazing to me to see the kids who were involved with the NSA, the National Stuttering Association, or with friends, or with Our Time, and to see the kids who got involved in that when they were 7, 8, 9, 10, who are now in their early 20s, and how confident those kids are, how okay with themselves they are, how okay with their stuttering they are, and it's just made a huge difference in so many of those kids' lives. Again, just talking about your stuttering, and also just being around other people your own age who stutter, and knowing that it really is okay. You know, you can talk about stuttering being okay forever, but until you really talk with other people who stutter your own age, either about stuttering or about something that has nothing to do with stuttering, and you start to realize, wow, this person really is okay and they stutter. Well, maybe I'm okay too. Hmm. And so to me, it's so cool to see those kids who have really been involved in support groups for a while and just how great they're doing.
So, Joe, I know in preparation for this episode on stuttering modification, you have reviewed an awful lot, or a good lot, of materials. Is there anything you'd like to share with us from your readings?
You know, one thing that I would like to share is just a story from Ann Riper, from his famous textbook, The Treatment of Stuttering, from the early 1970s, and it's where he really explains sort of how he came upon this kind of therapy. So this is from page 301 and 302 from The Treatment of Stuttering. Once, while hitchhiking on a back road near Rhinelander, Wisconsin, I was picked up by a very old man in an old car. Though the old fellow was very fluent and garrulous, he spoke in an unusual way with many little jerky prolongations of the first sounds of his words, and he talked about the weather and such. Finally, he ceased his monologue and asked me a whole barrage of questions. I remember stuttering terribly as I tried to answer them, even flailing around in the car with body contortions. The old man began to laugh outrageously and so interminably, I almost hit him. Finally, recognizing my furious anger, he suddenly stopped and said, "Now take it easy, son. Take it easy. I know how it is to stutter like you do. That's why I was laughing. It's crazy to stutter like that. But when I was your age, I used to spit and sputter and jerk and stutter just the way you're doing, but no more. I'm too old and too tired to stutter hard anymore, so I don't. I just stutter and let them leak out." For the rest of that ride and for hours afterwards, I was in a daze of revelation. All of his life, he had been trying to talk without stuttering, and the more he tried, the more he had failed. The old man had by chance found out how to stutter without struggling. It was incredible, but it was possible to stutter and yet to be very fluent. Even now, after almost 50 years, I remember the vividness of that insight, that flash of bright light in the darkness of despair. And so that's really how Van Riper started to realize, you know, I can stutter differently. I don't have to stutter in the same hard way over and over and over again. And I just think that's a really cool story of kind of how he came upon the idea of being able to stutter more easily.
Oh, I'm so glad you read that passage, Joe. I had a copy of that book when I first entered speech therapy. I had that book. Somebody gave me a copy of Malcolm Fraser's Self-Therapy for the Stutter, and I can remember reading that passage almost two decades ago.
Yeah.
And I just got chills. I just got chills because, you know, for me, reading Van Riper's chapter on treatment, I think it's just one chapter in that book, right, where he discusses his own treatment.
Right. He breaks it down. He has a chapter on identification, a chapter on desensitization, and then a chapter on modification.
Oh, that's right. So it's a chapter on each part. And I remember, like, that to me, reading Van Riper, reading Malcolm Fraser, that was the guy in the truck who picked me up and said, "You can do it differently."
Yeah,
you know,
that
was the first time I had realized, wait a second, when my mouth feels like it's glued shut, I'm allowed to open it, you know?
Right.
I don't remember if it was Van Riper or Malcolm Fraser who were talking. I know Van Riper certainly did, where he talked about stutterers change the vowel when we stutter. And why don't you practice stuttering with the right vowel to get closer to where you want to be?
Absolutely.
You know, and that was like being in a pickup truck with Van Riper and getting the best advice. So I'm so glad you shared that, Joe. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. That's just it's a great scene of kind of how this whole idea came to be.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if we're going to end up keeping this part in the show, but when you go back and you listen to, have you ever heard the Van Riper audio clips from the Stuttering homepage?
I have.
And you sometimes have to wonder if we've idolized him a bit too much. Like, I have to wonder how open he would be to all of the self-help stuff going on now and all the talking about stuttering. Because a lot of him seems like the type of guy who said, you just get out there and you do it, you know? So I wonder now how he would take to, you know, participating in a local chapter of the National Stuttering Association.
Well, you really have to take him for a man of his time. I mean, he very specifically says in that same book about how you shouldn't go to group therapy because you just have a bunch of people who stutter whining about stuttering.
I don't recall that. That's wild.
He actually says that, but that was just, you know, that was really before all the support groups really came to be in the 1970s. And so, you know, he didn't really have the benefit of knowing about that yet. So yeah, I think he'd be very surprised to see all the people involved in stuttering support and how helpful being involved in stuttering support can be for lots of people who stutter.
That those pages you just read are also in support of stuttering support, where, you know, in that pickup truck, there was a little support conversation going on, talking about stuttering.
Absolutely, absolutely. No question about it.
So, Joe, as we're nearing the end of this super stuttering modification episode, let's talk about the therapeutic alliance, which would apply to all therapies. Help everybody put this together. How important do you think the therapeutic alliance is in stuttering modification treatment, that bond between the client and the therapist?
Well, it's, to me, it's absolutely huge, in that you've got to have that, relationship with the client and the therapist, where each week, every 2 weeks, whatever the therapy schedule is, the client can really come in and you can work on what's most important to that client. You really, the client and the therapist have a shared understanding as far as what the problem is, what the goals are, and how you're going to solve that problem. And to me, if you're working with your client trying to figure out, well, gosh, you know, he's stuttering really hard and having a long block, what is it that he can do to make that block shorter and easier and smoother and to move through that block? And if he's having very negative feelings about stuttering, you know, what are some things like voluntary stuttering and other things that the client can do? And so if you have a client and a therapist who are really working together to solve a problem, I think you can really get a tremendous amount accomplished. Whereas if you have a therapy that's maybe more like a recipe, that depending on, it doesn't matter who the client is, you'll do the same kind of therapy for every single client, that to me, you won't get the same kind of positive outcomes from that.
That sounds right to me. And I have to wonder about the therapeutic alliance. Just in me, just a case study of one. I mean, when I was working on my speech with a speech therapist and we were working on stuttering openly and stuttering voluntarily while also working on stuttering less, there was a situation. Well, you know, when I was in grad school, my department wanted me to work on fluency shaping. And, you know, my goal at the time was to stop being covert, to stop avoiding, and to stutter better and to allow myself to say what I wanted to say. And, you know, by the time I was in grad school, my covert behaviors were incredibly diminished and I was working through stutters. And at that point, if I had to switch gears and start focusing on fluency and start being scared again about the possibility of stuttering, I don't think that would have been the best therapeutic alliance for me. I fail to see how, for me, I maybe I'm wrong here, Joe, but I'm not sure. The nicest fluency shaping therapist, if they were doing it strict fluency shaping, I don't see how the therapeutic alliance could have helped me overcome the simple fact that I was done chasing fluency.
Right. Well, and it also, you know, if for you as a covert stutterer, your problem was that you were trying not to stutter, and if you were going to a therapist who was going to teach you a different way not to stutter, that's just not – that really isn't an alliance, because you're talking about two different things. And so, you know, it's just feeding into that same problem. So you know, at that point in your life, you had to be with somebody who had a shared goal with you for, all right, you know, you've come to realize that hiding your stuttering is not working. It's terrible. It's really having a negative impact on your life. And the only way out of this is to do the opposite of that, which is to do some stuttering and to work on your stuttering and think about your stuttering and talk about your stuttering. And so that ended up perfectly. And so I totally agree with you that for you, it wouldn't matter who the therapist was. If they were working on fluency, it wouldn't have worked.
So I could talk to you all day, Joe, but let's move on to some concluding thoughts here. And I think I've got a pretty good clip here on a way to help bring us out. Recently on Stutter Talk, we featured Dylan Reed on episode 325. And of course, I met Dylan through you. So thank you so much for helping him get down to the Friends Workshop here in North Carolina.
No problem. He's a great guy. He's an amazing man. I like Dylan a lot.
Yeah, he is a really cool guy. And, you know, I asked Dylan about the importance of talking about stuttering with his speech therapist, and he answered it in an interesting way where it sounded like he was saying his speech therapist did a good job of listening about stuttering. So let's listen to the clip.
The biggest help that my speech therapy had was that we could talk about my stuttering. And I guess it helped me to put it in a light where I can talk about it.
Can you remember how your speech therapist and you would discuss stuttering? Like, how would she bring it up with you, or what would you guys talk about?
We would do the whole basic, like the easy onset, the flashcards, the deep breath exercises and all that. But at the end of the day, we took like 20 minutes and she just asked me how my day was. And I'd start to talk, and then she'd ask me, I'd say, well, I had a tough time in this class because a kid was talking about my speech. And she just, I guess, let me carry the conversation, and she'd give her and her two cents in that would force me to think about how I felt during those times.
So Joe, does that surprise you where I wanted to know from Dylan, you know, how did your speech therapist talk to you about stuttering? And it really turns out, from his memory at least, that she just created a space where he could talk about stuttering and she could listen. What do you make of that?
Well, that's, I think that's huge. I mean, just for a number of reasons. The first is that your client can't learn anything about how your client talks if you're talking. So, you know, the client needs to be the one doing most of the talking during the sessions. And then when I'm a therapist, I really want my clients to be the one who really are able to discover their stuttering and discover what they're doing. So, you know, I find for me that my best therapy sessions occur when I'm not doing a lot of talking, and the talking I'm doing is more asking questions and having the client really think and talk about what they're doing when they stutter, and then to do some problem solving as far as what they could be doing differently. So, you know, I think he's right on when he says that, you know, the best times were when he was talking and he was not only educating his therapist about stuttering, he was probably educating himself about stuttering when he was talking about it.
Joe, Dr. Joseph Klein, I'd like to thank you for joining us today on Stutter Talk and for, well, I know you spent an incredible amount of time preparing for this episode, and I just can't thank you enough, man.
Peter, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I apologize that I have a cold. Oh, I hope that listening to it will be as pleasurable as being a part of it was.
Oh, I'm sure it will be. Listeners, send your questions and comments to stuttertalk@stuttertalk.com. And for the show notes, you could go to stuttertalk.com, episode 329. And Joe, as always, I can't wait to get you back for another episode, man.
This sounds great, Peter. I'm happy to. Thanks a lot.